All right, and now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Sandy Ann from Kalifornsky Beach, Alaska.
I'm Sandy, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. You newcomers, welcome. I know when I was new, I cringed when someone would say they're a grateful alcoholic, because I wasn't grateful. I was losing my best friend. How could anybody be happy or grateful? But I learned. I stuck around long enough to learn. My home group is the Stepsisters in Soldotna, Alaska. Soldotna is the big town near where I live. It's got about 2,000 people. And in the summer, all the fishermen come, and there's maybe 20,000 people in Soldotna. So we have an abundance of restaurants, which is really nice. Cay Beach might have about 800 people. No one calls it Kalifornsky Beach. But the Russians settled Alaska after they settled Northern California, and they named that area after California. Of course, they had to put a ski on the end of it. My sobriety date is January 30th, 1983, and thanks to my higher power, you people, and the steps, I haven't found it necessary to go back out and drink once I first walked into these rooms. I was afraid to go back out. I was afraid you wouldn't let me back in. So, you know, sometimes fear is a good thing. I'm a crier. I always cry. I brought plenty of Kleenex. Last weekend, I should tell you, I didn't travel down here from Alaska for this meeting. Sorry. I'm a snowbird, and we winter in Bullhead City, Arizona. So last weekend, across the river in Laughlin, Nevada, they had AA Roundup, and I had the good privilege, the good fortune to attend a ton of meetings from Thursday through Sunday. And they had some fabulous speakers. And I'm sitting there watching them and looking at them. And one speaker had everybody in stitches. My sides hurt so much by the time he was finished. And he had a great message and delivered it with humor. Another woman had such a heartbreaking story between the people she killed with her drunk driving and so forth. Everyone was in tears. And another woman was fabulous. She had the whole book memorized. She was talking about something and says, and at the bottom of page 33, it says, and she quoted it verbatim, and she had no paper up there to look at. And page 49, if you look at that, it says, and I'm thinking, I should start doing that. I should go through the book and find all my favorite passages and write them down and put the page number on there so I'll look like a real guru also. All I got is water and Kleenex. Sorry. I didn't plan on being an alcoholic. Is there anyone here when you were young, you wanted to be an alcoholic when you grew up? You? You're weird. My parents were alcoholics, and they were nasty, violent drunks. Shot in a beer drunk, and I didn't have a good childhood. But my grandmother lived with us until I was 7, and she was my protector. She was my guardian. She was my everything. My mother would drink during the day and get nasty and violent towards me, not my older sister, but towards me, and my grandmother would protect me. She'd see my mother, her daughter-in-law, get on a tear, and she'd grab me and pull me off into her room and basically hide me until my mother settled down, which was great. And my uncle lived with us, and he motivated me. He encouraged me. He told me, even when I was 10 years old, I could do anything, I could be anything I wanted. And it was good to hear that because my parents told me, you're lousy, rotten, no good, never going to amount to nothing. I heard that from about age 8 on. And my father would get home from work a little bit after 4. He'd have the beer and the whiskey bottle out, and they'd be drinking. And usually my mother had started dinner before then, or my grandmother fixed dinner for us. But so there was my uncle, my grandmother, my parents, my older sister and myself living in a 900-square-foot house, one bathroom, and it was kind of tight. And then my parents had a boy when I was about seven. My grandmother moved out, and I had been my father's pride and joy up until then, and he used to beat the daylights out of my older sister to keep it even. My mother would beat up on me, and then my grandmother moved out, so I didn't have a protector, and I wasn't my dad's pride and joy. So, I mean, life got really miserable for quite a few years. I don't remember my first drink, but there's a picture of me with a quart beer bottle with a baby nipple stuck on it, and I'm sitting there doing this at about 6 months of age. And I know, I'm sure my mother gave me beer in the baby bottle to go to sleep at night because she did it with the three younger kids. It would help us sleep through the night so she wouldn't have to, you know, get up. My first drunk, well, after my grandmother moved out, things were miserable, and I did something wrong one time, I don't know what it was, and I was about 10. And my mother picked up the belt. Instead of holding the two ends in her hand, she was holding it in the middle of the belt and swinging it like crazy. And she broke my glasses, cut my lid where it was bleeding real bad, and I had welts all over me. And she's screaming, wait till your father gets home, you're really going to get it. And I thought, you know, I'm not stupid. I am going to get it when he gets home. I'm not sticking around. It was summer. My grandmother was gone. My uncle had just moved out also. And I snuck into my room, got whatever money I had. It was less than a dollar. Went and hopped on a bus in Chicago and took a bus for 8 miles out to my grandmother in my uncle's apartment. And my grandmother opened the door when I got there. She looked at me and said, what happened? And I said, Mother. And she said, come in. And she locked the door and wasn't going to answer the phone while I was there because she was going to hide me. My grandmother spoke very poor English, more Polish than English. And she kept me hidden. And then my uncle came up over, got home about 8 o'clock at night, took a look at me. What happened? She got into a fight with her mother. Okay, I'm going to stay here. He called up my parents and said, we're going to keep her for a while. And that was wonderful. That was heaven. My uncle owned a health spa, so he took me to work with him a couple days. He took me out to nice restaurants for lunch. He took me golfing with him, and it was just heavenly. And all I could think of, oh, and he took me home after a while. It was summer, and I could stay there. He took me home, and I heard him telling my parents, I don't ever want to see marks like that on her again. You better learn to control yourself, or we're going to take her. The other kids he was going to leave, but my mother had it in for me because my father had it in for my older sister. And if that makes any sense to any of you, you're obviously alcoholic. But anyways, that year, that Christmas, we were over at my uncle and my grandmother's house, and one of my uncles was tending bar, I went over there and I said, can I have some? And my mother yelled, no soda for her. And he said, well, how about some orange juice? Okay, orange juice. And then he does this, and he pours maybe a capful of vodka in it. And, oh, boy. Well, you know, there wasn't that much orange juice. There was a lot of ice cubes. And then when that was gone, I went and had another one, and I fixed it. And I'm 10 years old. I'm not too smart as far as how much to pour. But I know it was good, and I was happy. And I was talking intelligently with my aunts and, you know, discussing different stuff. I don't know what, but I know I came across having it all together because that's how I felt. And one of my uncles complimented me on how mature I was getting. And I'm enjoying these, and I don't know how many I had. But about 10 o'clock at night, I stumble into the bathroom and I tell my uncle who lived there, I'm sick. And he said, oh, you had too many Christmas cookies and cakes and orange juice on top of it. That'll sour your stomach. He gave me an Alka-Seltzer. And I promptly threw up everything. But I did learn a good lesson. I haven't had an Alka-Seltzer since. you know, I was happy. I felt good. I got rid of all the stuff in my stomach. So I went and I had another one. And then we went to midnight mass, and I'm happy, and I'm feeling great. And, you know, nothing bad happened to me when I ran away. The next time I got in trouble at home was with my father over something. And I snuck out the back door, and I started walking, and I didn't know where I was going to walk. But I started walking, and I came a couple miles away to one of my girlfriend's house. And I went and knocked on her door, and she said, "Oh, how nice to have you here. My dad's working nights tonight." I said, "Oh, good. Can I stay?" "Sure." Didn't tell my mother I was gone a couple days. I ran away probably 10 times between the ages of 10 and 16. And I wouldn't recommend it for any young girls today, but I was extremely fortunate. Nothing bad ever happened to me. I did get picked up by the police a few times. I got taken to juvenile hall in Chicago. I liked it. It was nice there. Nobody yelled at me. Nobody hit me. I didn't have to take care of three younger kids and do laundry and, you know, clean the floor and whatever else. It was like a nice vacation. I enjoyed juvenile hall. The last time I went there, I was 16, and the courts had decided that I was a habitual runaway, which was a crime at that time, and they said they were going to have me placed. And they had this house called the House of Good Shepherd, and it was a girls' facility. And turns out when I toured the place, there was a couple girls there that I went to school with. And so I got them aside, and I talked to them, and they said, "Yeah, our curfew during the week is 9 o'clock unless we have a job. And on weekends, it's 11, and I thought, dang, my curfew on the weekends is 10 o'clock. You know, and I liked the place. I was looking forward to it. We were ready to go back to court the following week. And as soon as I gave my consent in court, then I would be moving into that place. And then my parents found out they'd have to contribute something towards my support. So they weren't too happy about that. And my mother pulled me aside and she says, "You know that bum you're dating?" "Yeah." "Well, if you want to marry him, we'll sign papers for you." And I thought, wow, I can do whatever I want. I can drink if I feel like it. I can, I'll always be taken care of and loved and protected. And so I said, "Sure, I'll go call him." So I went and I called him and I said, "Hey, Marty, my mother said they'll sign papers if we want to get married." And he says, I'm sure he was thinking about, wow, sex every day and twice on Sunday. We were both disappointed. Anyways, he says, "Wow, okay, that might be fun. Let me go ask my mother." You know, it was doomed, right? I got pregnant. I had a baby that was 3 months premature. She had everything imaginable wrong with her. I was overwhelmed. I was depressed. She weighed 2.5 pounds at birth, got down to 1.5 pounds. My husband is thinking that, you know, it would be better if God would just take her home. And I'm thinking, no, I'm going to bring her home here. So I'm not drinking. I'm trying to be a good mother for the social workers that were coming out. And they checked the house, and she'd have pneumonia. And then they found out she had heart problems. And this went on for 6 months. And she's always going to come home, and she's not. And she was in 3 different hospitals and a couple of different nursing homes for infants. And I'm no fun. And, oh, by the way, I found out I was pregnant again. And I'm 17. I'm overwhelmed. I'm depressed. My husband comes home, you know, maybe once a week. I had to beg money out of him. I'm a high school dropout. I have a job that pays 10 cents an hour over minimum wage, totally unskilled. 17 years old, and I'm pregnant again. And I know this goes against the grain, but I'm really grateful they didn't have the same abortion laws back then that they do now, because I would have missed the most wonderful, awesome daughter ever. So, while I'm pregnant, I was smart enough not to drink, thank you God. My mother drank like a fish throughout all of her pregnancies, and I have one brother that I swear has fetal alcohol effect. But my grandmother told me, don't drink, don't smoke. You'll make small babies, you'll make sick babies. Don't drink, don't smoke. But after she was born, and then my husband was coming home maybe once a month to pay the rent, and I wanted to run away. I was so overwhelmed, I was so depressed, and how am I going to run away? I got one newborn baby. I can't. You can't couch surf with a kid in tow, right? And besides, there was no reason for me to go anywhere because I had the apartment, small as it was, all to myself. It was two rooms. My daughter slept in the closet. That's where her crib went because there wasn't much. I didn't have much in the way of clothes. My husband had moved his stuff out. So I can't run away, but I knew I could run away with alcohol. And my neighbors thought I was in my 30s when I'm 18. And I could buy booze with no difficulty whatsoever from any liquor store, any grocery store. They never carded me because I looked old. And my hair started graying in my teens also. So I could go to work, I could come home, and I could drink. And that's what I did. And then I met this guy, and he said, no, you can't keep drinking screwdrivers. They'll mess with your stomach. If you want to be a successful drinker, you got to switch to scotch. So he gets me a scotch and water, and I said, ooh, tastes like cobwebs. And he says, you have to drink it enough so that you acquire a taste for it. I was acquiring a taste, and then I discovered all these fancy liqueurs, you know, like Grand Marnier and Kahlua and Creme de Menthe, and oh my God, this is better than having cake and ice cream, some of these drinks. I could drink. This guy that I was by, we were divorced by this time, my first husband and I, and I'm dating this guy, and he would come over 2-3 nights a week to my apartment, and he started drinking an awful lot, more than I was, you know, and I thought I had a decent tolerance, or I thought he did, because guys usually have better tolerance, but he was getting drunk and passing out on the couch, and after about a month or 2 months of this, I told him, you know, you got a drinking problem. It's pretty obvious. You need to go to AA. So I'm 21 years old, and I'm telling this guy he has a drinking problem. And then I said, if you're not going to drink for a week, I won't either. By Friday of that week, I was climbing walls. And he was never around. I never saw him because he was going to meetings every night. And Fridays at work, all the handful of us women would go out for lunch, and we'd always have a drink, and I didn't have a drink, and that irritated me no end. And why am I doing this for him when I don't have a problem? I can drink and handle it, and he can't. So that Saturday morning, he came over, and I said, you know, you've really gone a whole week without drinking? And he said, yeah. And I said, wow. Well, then obviously you're not an alcoholic. If you want a drink, that's fine with me. So I got the bottle of champagne out of the fridge, and we celebrated. Nice. I broke up with him a couple months later anyways, you know, but I don't know if he ever got sober again or not. But when I was at my most depressed period, I thought, I can't do this anymore. So I went to welfare, and I said, I got a newborn baby. I'm only making X number of dollars a week. I'm going to quit my job. Tomorrow will be my last day, and I need to go on welfare. And the woman looked at me, and this is before welfare became an entitlement, if you're a single mother or something. She said, girl, nothing wrong with you. You go get a better job. If you can't support yourself on this job, get a better job. And I left there, and I cried myself to sleep. I drank myself to sleep. I was so upset. The day after that, the girl that grew up next door to me called me up, and she wasn't real bright. If they'd had special ed back then, she would have been in it. And she said, I just got hired by this insurance company, and they're paying me whatever it was, $15 a week more than what I was making. And she says, you ought to go and apply there. You'll make more money. And I thought, I got to do something. I went and applied, and I had they gave you this stupid little Wunderlich test. It's 50 questions. You have 6 minutes. And if you can get through everything, you know, they might hire you if you get at least 40 out of the 50 right. Well, I got all 50 right. And 20 math problems I got right. And when I applied at this job, I was like 19 or something, and I told him I had 2 years of college, but since I just got divorced, I had to get a better job and go back to school and couldn't stay in college. And they never checked anything. So I got my first good job under false pretenses. And they started me out at like double what I had been making, and they trained me, and I had a wonderful 24-year career in insurance because of that. Even getting a pension from one of them. So, you know, I was really fortunate, but fortunate I finally got sober, or I wouldn't have kept the last one. But anyways, I was very good at that, and I told the boss one time, I really want your job. And he said, well, you don't have a college degree, and we only promote people with degrees. So, and I said, okay, I'm going to go back to college. I was still a high school dropout, no GED or anything, and I started looking into what I had to do to get to start college. First, I had to get my GED, and then I talked to my uncle, and he said, well, you know, a single parent, you can get grants, loans, scholarships, and all that stuff, and do you know what you want to get your degree in? Yes. So I started college. I quit my job, and my ex-husband, after about 3 months, 4 months of working part-time and going to school, and just not being able to hold it all together. And I said, well, I've had our daughter for 4 years. Now it's your turn. You take her the next 4 years so I can go to college. And he says, no, 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 no. I can't do that. And I said, you got a wife now? You can do it. You can afford babysitters if your wife is working. And no, no, no. He said, I'll tell you what. I'll pay you double. Now, he hadn't paid child support hardly at all. But he says, whatever we agreed on, I don't know, 25 a week or something. And he said, I'll give you double that, 50. And I said, that'll pay the babysitter, and that'll pay our food and the utilities. Nope, won't work. You take her. And he said, 75 a week. Nope, 100 a week. Okay. So for a year, he paid 4 years' worth of child support in 1 year's time so I could get a good foundation in college. And when he and his second wife divorced, his income was cut in half, so all I got was 25 a week after that. But I got a good foundation in college, and in college I found the ski club. It was a commuter college, University of Illinois in Chicago, so nobody lived on campus, but they had different clubs you can join, and I joined the ski club. And my darling, sweet, wonderful mother-in-law would take our daughter for the weekend while I go skiing up in Wisconsin, and it was drinking on the 10-hour bus ride up, drinking up there at the youth hostel, drinking after skiing a couple of runs, and drinking all the way back. And it was so much fun. And it was like, I'm finally having the fun that everyone else has when they're 16, 18, 20, 21. I'm finally having that now. And I could hold my booze pretty good. You know, like you were saying, could hold the booze. I did pretty good. And I used to think that I would never have a problem with alcohol because it was never a forbidden fruit. And it, because I had started drinking so young, I had good tolerance built up. I have since learned that that's a fallacy. The younger you start drinking, the more likely it is for a person to become an alcoholic, but that's all right. Anyways, I went back to work. I got a job. I told that boss when I was interviewed that I won his job, and he says, great, but you'll have to get transferred and go work in our home office in Winnipeg, Canada. And I said, I could do that. So I worked there in that office, was promoted to supervisor real quick, went to Winnipeg, Canada. And they told me it didn't snow until Thanksgiving. They didn't tell me Canadian Thanksgiving was in October. And Winnipeg had these stupid blue laws. You could only buy Labatt's beer at a Labatt's beer store. If you wanted a Molson beer, you had to go to the Molson beer store. If you wanted hard booze, you had to go to the government-run liquor store, which was open from 9 to 4 when I was at work. So, I mean, they really made it difficult. And then on top of that, they had these laws where if you're at a bar, the bar has to shut down from 5 to 6. Now, I mean, that's happy hour. I'd never seen anything so stupid. But if you join a club, the private club, you can drink throughout. So that's what I did. I joined a curling club. Worked up there for a year and a half at 50 below with 60-mile-an-hour winds the first winter. Didn't like it. Convinced them to transfer me back to the States. They sent me to San Francisco, and it was like I died and went to heaven. I found all kinds of people my age, with some with kids to party with, to have great fun with. For about 3 years, I had a ball that was volleyball on Monday night, and then everyone would go over to someone's house and drink beer and wine. And another night was some other activity, and there was a party every single weekend, and I'm drinking and having fun, and I never got a DUI. You got all my DUIs. I only got stopped once, and that was I had left work early in San Francisco and was driving down the peninsula, and I was doing like 20 miles over the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit back then, and I had a joint in my hand and a scotch in my other hand, and I'm doing the steering wheel, and I'm singing with the radio, and all of a sudden I hear in the loudspeaker, you know, pull over now. I go, look, me? Ooh. Put the joint out, close the ashtray, put the drink under the seat, it spilled. The car had to reek. And then he says, I've been following you for 10 miles with the siren and the lights going. I said, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm getting my license out. There's a picture of my daughter in her little school uniform. And I said, I'm sorry. I'm just so upset. The school called me and said she passed out and was taken to the hospital. Total lie. And he said, how is your daughter? What's your daughter going to think if nobody ever comes to pick her up? And I said, oh, I never thought of it. Oh, my gosh. And he says, I'll give you a pass, but you better not speed. Thank you, officer. He left, and I'm laughing my head off. I pulled a fast one. It's the only time I ever got stopped. I drove in blackouts. I came to once in the middle of a blackout, and there was my exit. So I took it anyways on two wheels. Didn't roll the car. One time I was up skiing in Tahoe, and everybody went up to the lodge, and we had to walk up where our cabins were. We had to walk up about 80 steps, and they were icy, and I don't remember getting up there, but coming down on the way down, I remember my hand is freezing, touching this wooden banister that was all frozen, and I looked up, and I looked around, and I saw where I was, and it was like, oh, dear God, I can't do this. And the next thing I know, it's the next morning, I came to in my bed, got my boots on, my clothes, everything still on. How I got down, I don't know. I started to, you talked about moving. I did that too. I lived in Chicago and Winnipeg and San Francisco and San Jose and Houston and Denver and back to San Jose and down to Los Angeles. All of that at courtesy of my employer. Because I was such a hot shot, I did a great job. They'd move me here. I'd open an office. I'd train everybody, hire everybody. And after a year, 2 years, I'm bored. Okay, we got another challenge for you, and they'd move me again. And I found out in AA that those were called geographics. But smarter than the average bear, my company paid for all those geographics. They would sell my house, pay all the expenses. They'd put me up in hotels. They'd, ship my furniture down. I mean, I really was fortunate and blessed until I wasn't. My last move was to Los Angeles, and I'd been down there a month, and I had lost all of my girlfriends. The women no longer wanted to have anything to do with me in Northern California, so I thought I'll move to L.A. and I can start over. But you can't meet people if you don't leave your house. And I'm running my company's largest office. I can't date anybody that I work with or that works for me. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I go to work and I'd come home and drink. And I'm such a kind boss. I put in flex time at every office I went to or opened up. Come in any time between 6:30 and 9:30 in the morning. Leave any time between 3 and 6. Just get your hours in. So no one noticed if I came in at 9:30 and left at 2:30 because I couldn't last a whole day. I had a friend from grammar school come and visit me in Los Angeles right after I got there. And I fixed a nice dinner, nice drinks before dinner, wine with dinner. After dinner, it was Grand Marnier. And I kept trying to fill his glass. No, I'm fine. And the last time I went into the kitchen, I poured some Grand Marnier, and there was about this much left in the bottle, and I thought, I'll just chug a lug from the bottle. And after I did that, I thought, this doesn't feel right. But 2 weeks later, I started drinking on a Friday. I came to on Sunday morning. I was in a blackout the whole weekend. I trashed my house. It looked like someone broke in and destroyed it completely. I don't know why or what I was doing, but that was my last drunk. And I left the house looking like a cyclone hit it. Oh, and I came to in my guest bedroom. No idea why. I was home alone all weekend, but I had had blackouts, quite a few of them, but I had never heard of a blackout. I didn't know what it was, and I thought I had some deep, serious mental issue, like multiple personalities. Somebody else took over. You know, when people would tell me what I did, that wasn't me. I wouldn't do that. I'm not that kind of person. But anyways, I sat there on that Sunday, and when I got up, I got down on my knees and I cried and I said, please, God, you got to do something. And for once, I didn't tell God what he had to do to take care of my problem. I just, please do something. So I left the house looking like a cyclone hit it. I cried. I shook. I went to work on Monday. I was a screaming Mimi over the loudspeaker. So-and-so, get in here now. And I mean, I was just awful. And I kept shaking, and I wouldn't leave my desk to go out at lunch because I didn't know how to go to a restaurant without eating something or drinking something. And after a week, I called AA. I had worked with a woman for quite a few years, and she had 7 years in the program. And I thought, she doesn't drink. She doesn't get drunk anymore. Maybe I'll find out what she does. And she goes to AA. Okay, I'll go to AA. They'll teach me how to drink like a lady. And they called, I called central office. They sent a woman out. And she proceeded to tell me every gory detail of her life. And I said, no. You see, I'm not an alcoholic. I just have a slight problem. And she says, that's fine. And you see, I just got this big promotion. I'm running my company's largest office. And she says, I'm a real estate broker. I own 6 real estate offices. I get a commission off over 100 agents. And I just bought this house. And she says, I'm having one built out in Acton, which is a ritzy horse community. And I said, I got this cute little sports car. And she says, is it as nice as my Mercedes? And she says, it doesn't matter what you have or what you've done. You know, it all boils down to what happens when you take that first drink. Can you stop when you want to? Can you predict what you're going to do? Can you predict how much you're going to drink? No. She dragged me off to a meeting, and everybody was laughing. And I thought, it was a newcomers meeting. Newcomers, with less than a year, were supposed to get up and share. And, 5 minutes or whatever, and they would tell some horrible things about their lives. You know, like the woman that said she got up and she took her kid to the babysitter and went out partying and forgot she had kids. And finally on Sunday, the babysitter called her and said, when are you going to come and get your kids? And I thought, oh, I would never tell anybody. But I did that once. You know, I didn't get DUIs because I was lucky. I didn't lose a job because my boss was always 1,000 miles away. I didn't lose any relationships because I hadn't been married since I was 18. I also couldn't find anybody that would stick around long enough. You know, my life just wasn't going well. And I went into this meeting, and then afterwards they said, let's go out for coffee. Okay. I went for coffee with them, and I said, we just had coffee and cake there. Everyone ordered cake and coffee. And they laughed, and they told jokes. And it was like, okay. And they said, oh, you got to come tomorrow morning. We do a breakfast, all you can eat for $2.50. Wow, okay. That's a nice price. Eggs, pancakes, sausage, ham, whatever you want. And then I was getting ready to leave at about 9:30. And they said, oh, no, you can't leave. The speaker meeting is at 10. So I stayed for that. And then when that was over, I'm coming out, and someone says, we do a spiritual meeting here at 2 o'clock on Sunday. And I said, well, I already went to church. They said, no, this isn't religion. You know, forget religion. This is spirituality. This is you and your connection with the God of your own understanding, not someone else's understanding. And a young people's meeting that night, because I was young at the time, I kept going to meetings, and I didn't drink, and I stopped shaking, and I stopped crying. And I finally got a sponsor who told me, you know, you got all these reservations. Write down every stupid, idiotic, crazy thing you've ever done. Not fifth step or fourth step kind of stuff, but just stupid stuff. You know, like leaving your car someplace that you can't find it. You know, weird stuff. Write all that down. I had 4 or 5 pages. I read it to her. She said, this is great. Okay. I want you to keep this list and read it. Anytime you think about drinking, read this list. To show how unmanageable your life was. And insanity, we talked a lot about the multiple personalities. Because there was some book out then, Sybil or something, multiple personalities, and that's what I thought was going on. And we just talked about my insanity. It was a different form of insanity than that multiple personalities. And the fact that I hadn't had any blackouts in, a month, 2 months. Third step, I could not get it. How do I know I've done it? So she made me memorize it, and I had to write the third step prayer on little stickies and stick them all over the place. My computer at work, my phone at work, on my chair when I sat down, in the downstairs bathroom, upstairs bathroom, my bedroom. I had them everywhere, all over the car. And I was about 4 months sober, and I had some eye surgery. Couldn't drive to work. I was getting rides. My staff loved to drive me to work because then they could park in my spot right next to the elevator at our building. That was good. So I'm driving to work. Oh, after a month, I get the stitches out, and I still got a patch on my eye, and I can't see very well, and it got smoggy in Los Angeles that June. It was horrible. But I'm driving. I get behind the wheel of my car on a Monday morning at 7:30 and get on the I-5, and the smog is bad, and my eyes weeping something fierce, makes my good eye not be able to see. And I'm thinking, okay, God, I turn my will and my life in this car over to you. Please don't let me hurt anyone. And then I said the third step prayer, and I could feel the tension leave my neck and my shoulders. And I'm dabbing away like crazy at my eyes, and there's no car in front of me for at least 50 feet. I don't know where they went. It was stop and go, bumper to bumper. No car on either side of me, no car behind me for at least 50 feet. And I thought, oh, my God, this is what the third step feels like. You know, the tension is gone. I let go. I let God. And God did for me what I couldn't do for myself because there was no way I could clear that traffic out. And I left my car at work and rode home with somebody, you know, the next day. But I thought, wow, this is great. Fourth step, I got five, okay. The fourth step, I couldn't understand the book. These columns, it don't make sense, you know, because I'm resentful at my father because he was brutal and it affects my safety, but not anymore. And she says, do whatever you want. So I started writing and writing and writing. And I wrote about a 100-page narrative. And all the things that I put on there, the people that I hated and had resentments at and was so angry at, my sponsor showed me a different way of looking at the situation. She says, you know, your parents, as violent and brutal and nasty as they were, they set you up for success. And I said, what? And she says, because of their putting you down all the time, you were going to prove them wrong. So you not only got, you know, a great job, you got a college degree, you earned three times what your father ever made. You know, they set you up for success. And they're alcoholic like you. And my mother was raised in an orphanage. She, back in the 20s, they didn't take care of kids. They just fed them and clothed them. So she didn't even know what nurturing was like. But I'm grateful today I had my grandmother. I was angry at my ex. How dare he, you know, leave me with a little kid? But he enabled me to stay in college full-time for one whole year without having to work. You know, she showed me how to look at situations that upset me. And with a different perspective, oh, I'm glad that happened. You know, or I'm lucky. I'm grateful. God does for me what I couldn't do for myself, and I didn't recognize that that was God doing it at that time. So we spend hours, me reading this stuff. She burns it, and I says, how am I going to do my amends? And she says, oh, that's easy. And she picks up a piece of paper where she drew the lines and the grid and who I was resentful at and who I need to make amends for and everything. And it took me a while to get all my amends made. I did not want to make amends to one company that I worked for. One of the insurance companies, I embezzled a little money. But they didn't pay me enough. They didn't promote me. They didn't, you know, whatever. And she says, you know, that happened 15 years ago, and you still wrote about it. So obviously it's in the back of your mind. It bothers you. You need to make amends or you're going to get drunk. Didn't want to. Took me about 4 months. Oh, and she made me pay three times the amount of money that I embezzled, because of inflation and what they could have done with the money. And she had me write an anonymous letter saying I'm in a 12-step program that requires restitution. I embezzled money. Here is three times the amount that I embezzled when I worked in one of your offices. And I had to get like three money orders because they only went up to $500. I had the money. I could have done it. I was reluctant to do it. And she kept telling me, you're going to get drunk, you're going to get drunk, you're going to get drunk. I finally did it, and it was like, ha, hallelujah. So, you know, I'm running out of time, I'm sorry. I tried working the steps to the best of my ability. I do a lot of 12-step work today. I go out to the prison in Kenai, Alaska, usually 3 to 4 times a month. It's a men's prison, but they have the women's jail inside there. It's a real bizarre. You know, like you got all this glass wall, and one of those rooms is where the women are, and then the men are walking back and forth, and it's really bizarre. But I never got arrested. So my walls were mental, not metal. So I need to go and see what's out there waiting for me. I also have gone to this locked psychiatric facility in Los Angeles. I don't know if it's still there, but they announce AA meeting in the dining hall, and back then they would say free coffee and cigarettes provided. The patients would do the Thorazine shuffle in. First time I went there, I was so angry because I didn't sober anybody up. The guy that brought me there said, this is ridiculous, total waste of my time. And he says, no, you stayed sober. You can see what's out there waiting for you. And the people then were all, the patients were all old. They were like their 40s or 50s. The last time I went, when I had 8 years, none of them there were legally old enough to even drink. Drugs fried their brains so much quicker, you know. So it keeps me sober. There was one time I was so mad at somebody, I was going to either kill or get drunk. I drove to the liquor store. I was 3 years sober, and I thought, oh, wait a minute, I'm going to prison tomorrow. They won't let me in if I don't have a year. I'll get drunk tomorrow. Of course, I didn't, you know. Doing what it says in the book. You work the steps, you get a sponsor, you work with newcomers, you go to a lot of meetings. It works. At the end of this month, I'll have 35 years. So, and that's thanks to you and me following directions. So if you don't have a sponsor, get one. Go to meetings. You know, life can be much better than anything you anticipate. Got a house in Arizona, house in Alaska. We got a travel trailer to go back and forth with. Life is sweet. Life is wonderful. Thank you for keeping me sober one more day.